welcome back to another episode of the Tetracast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we've got the usual crew. We have Josh Torres.
The number one podcast for oatmeal enthusiasts.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
Try that oatmeal with maple syrup.
I'm not sure why we're talking about oatmeal, but oatmeal and bananas or strawberries are good. We're recording this in the middle of October. I know myself, presumably a lot of our listeners have been playing through Metaphor ReFantazio. Last week, we discussed Atlas's newest game in great detail. So if you haven't listened to that podcast, please go ahead and give that a listen through. Obviously, upcoming in October, we've got some major releases that are a little over a week away. We've got Romancing Saga 2, we've got Dragon Age Veilguard, and actually just based on the way that embargoes have lined up, one of the games that is also releasing before the end of the month in English that we're going to be spending a decent amount of time talking about today is the newest game in the East series, East 10. So we've had the opportunity to have Adam play through East 10 for review and put that up on the site. Adam, I'm not sure if anyone else on the site has also played through it.
Well, James and Chow played the Japanese.
Yeah, I played through it in Japanese because Falcom sent us a code at the time. So
gotcha.
Yeah, and then Chow did as well. Played it as well.
So maybe I'm the odd man out. So
no, it's me and you. I mean, I haven't played it either.
Gotcha. So yeah, so we're gonna be focusing a little bit on East 10 today because obviously it is coming up. We'll be releasing on the 25th. We're recording this on the 19th, so within a week. One of those rare releases nowadays where the embargo is actually significantly ahead of the release date. And then, of course, we're going to be catching up on all the other news as we go into late November timeframe, all the other games releasing before the end of the year. So that's what we're going to be starting on. There's also the Steam's Next Fest demos. We might have a few things to talk about there. We'll kind of play it by ear. And then a few, obviously, 2025 is not rapidly approaching, but it's down the road. It's around the corner. So we'll talk about a few updates to upcoming quarter one release dates for 2025. But without further ado, East 10. Adam, I'm just going to hand the microphone off to you to talk about your time with Adel's latest adventure.
Okay, so broadly speaking and outlining this, I'm going to talk about the things that I liked most about the game first. And then I'll talk about a few things that I was a little bit less positive on. And then we'll end on a high note with some other things that I liked about East 10. So in my review, the way I opened it is back in 2009, when East 7 came out for the PlayStation Portable, it made a pretty big change compared to all the East games before it, and that is that it added a playable party of characters. All the games up through East 6 basically had only one playable character. Usually it was Adel Kristen, who is the main character of the series, or in the case of East Origin, you had a few other characters that you could play as with Unica and Hugo. Is that his name right?
Unica, Hugo, and the Claw.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this was kind of the start of the like party system East era, and has persisted through for the last 15 years through East 9 Monstrum Nox. And I actually put up a review for East 7. Go ahead.
I was going to say that while that's true, I would say that there was a fairly large change with East 8, though East 8 and 9 were pretty identical. Yeah. With some slight changes.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a difference between like East 7 and Memories of Salsetta, and then from Salsetta to East 8 and 9. But they're kind of all party system. So you had like a playable cast of characters. And how do I put this? So I kind of felt like it was time for the East series to kind of change paradigms again. And I know some people like Chow have been waiting for this. To go maybe away from the party system, not necessarily back to like how it was before, but just, you know, try something new, try something different.
It's four games using the party system. I am sick of it, you know? It's the same thing with other games too. It's like, can you not use it more than two games? But Falcom tends to use it for more than four usually.
Yeah. But anyways, so that's kind of the key thing to key in on with East 10 is that it changes this up. There is no longer a playable party of characters. There are only two playable characters, Adel Kristen and the new heroine, Karja Balta. And while each of these characters has like their own like stats and equipment and skills, they don't really work like a two-person party. It's more like a two-person dyad. Like, you kind of work as a single unit throughout the game, just with two halves. And this, you're unlike previous games in the series where a lot of them had, like, you know, some characters had, like, strike damage or pierce damage or slash damage, and you would kind of, like, switch between characters to make sure that you would be using the most effective sort of damage. This game doesn't really have that. It has some sort of similar components, but really it's more just using Adel and Karja together as one unit, really, in playing through the game. And it makes it just a little bit, it gives the game a little bit, just a little bit, of like a character action game feel, although it is still clearly an RPG. So, setting up the premise, this game actually takes place early in the East timeline. If you're familiar with the East timeline, basically East 1 and 2 happen first, and then this happens immediately after. So the game actually opens up with Adel and Dogi. Dogi is Adel's basically traveling companion, talking about they need to get to Salsetta, which is the next game chronologically. That's number 4 in the series. But then they basically, on the way, run into the Normans and run into this basically Obelia Gulf section of the world, and run into this whole adventure that apparently happened when Adel was still a relatively fledgling adventurer. And here he meets, I actually forget the town's name, but he goes to a coastal town and he kind of learns about the...
Karnak?
Something like that. Anyways, what's basically how this part of the world works is that these coastal living people kind of live in this region, but they have the Norman pirates who kind of established like the law of the land. They sail the waters, and they basically they have tolls. They basically, you know, tell people where they're allowed to go or not. And then you kind of learn of some other conflicts that are kind of bubbling underneath the surface here about like the history of this area, and you go on an adventure. So the thing that I liked about this game the most, and I think easily can carry, do the heavy lifting and carry this game, regardless of everything else, is its combat. The combat is a hell of a lot of fun. It's a very, very entertaining, fun, fast-paced, colorful action RPG, which E-Series is relatively known for, but I think it even ups the ante a bit here. I believe this is the first game using Falcom's new engine, the first East game using Falcom's new engine, right? And there are some visual, I guess maybe weaknesses I'll talk about in a minute. But as far as like the combat goes, it's really fun. It's really high paced, really high energy. I've talked actually before a few times about different action games that have a sort of cadence where you're doing some sort of like A to B toggle and back to B to A toggle. Like, I'd actually talked about it with Reynatis a couple of weeks ago with its liberation and suppression modes. And also earlier in the year, I talked about Banishers, Ghosts of New Eden, which also had like this two playable character party switching thing that going on there. My point is both of those games, I kind of felt like flubbed that implementation. East 10 does not. It works really well. The key component to the combat system is the SP gauge. So SP, on the user interface, it looks like these little slanted blue rectangles. And that's what allows you to use skills in the game. The skills work like previous East games, where you have your normal attacks that you can do whenever you want, but then you have special abilities that cost SP to use. And basically how it works is this. When you're playing as Adel, Karja's SP refills rapidly, but Adel's SP will refill slowly. So you use a few of Adel's techniques, and then you switch over to Karja, and she has her own set of techniques, completely independent of Adel. And when you're using Karja, Adel's SP refills rapidly, and then Karja's will replenish slowly. So that's your like incentive to basically switch to Adel, use his abilities as you can, basically exhaust his SP, then switch to Karja, because her SP is filled in the meantime, use her abilities as you can, again, and they're very different from Adel's, and then switch back. So that's the cadence of the game. And then there's also a chain system in place where it's like a combo counter, where as you use these skills in Toggle, your combo counter goes up in increments. And as it goes up, your SP cost goes down. So basically, those two components are what are enticing you to basically switch between the two characters very, very regularly.
Yeah, and because they also have like these combined skills that cost a bunch of XP and are very powerful. But if you get the combo up high enough, or you get the opportunity to get the combo up high enough, eventually you can get to the point where you can kind of just even spam those, as long as you're not doing the same one over and over and over again, because you're spending less SP. And the way the combo system works is you can keep using the two same skills. You can do that. It won't break the combo. It's just you can't, like in previous party systems, you'd always find the one skill.
Yeah.
The one skill that you would always use. There was no reason to use anything else, pretty much. You can't do that here, where it's very inefficient to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as soon as you use the same skill twice, it breaks the chain. It's also enticing you to vary things up. And it, like I said, it's worked really well. And also over the course of the game, how do I put this? The game actually does a really good job, like, pacing the skills that you gain, where it always feels like you're gaining new skills at a good clip, where it doesn't feel overwhelming and the combat never gets stale. Whereas I feel like some action RPGs, like kind of like James was mentioning, you just find a skill that you like maybe 30-50% of the way through the game, and then you just spam it over and over and over and over again, and then the combat maybe just kind of becomes that and gets stale. But this game, I felt like up through the very end, I was always getting new skills. Even when Adol and Karja are reaching level 70, 80, level 90, you're still gaining new skills by the end of the game. And the skills do kind of appropriately raise the ante, raise the stakes, and get more and more flashy as you go through the game. So I think it does a good job just making it feel like it's always something new, always something different. And your
I also
skills.
Appreciate how like so much of Karja's, especially later skills, are like ice themed,
mm-hmm.
in like really interesting ways, like the big fuck off ice hammer thing.
That's a good one. Yeah. So Adol skills tend to have a fire, like theme to them. Not all of them, but some of them. And Karja's are ice. And there are status effects in the game where you can, if you do enough fire skills on an enemy, they can be burning, or if you do enough ice skills on an enemy, they can get frozen. I didn't really mess with that. Like, it happened when it happened, but I didn't, like, focus on that. As far as character building goes, there are certain skills that are definitely more well-suited for, like, AoE. For example, the big fuck-off ice hammer technique, which is its official name, is a technique that Karja uses that basically just hits a wide area and can do really good crowd control. By the way, that's not actually its real name. I just like it. Then there's also certain techniques that are clearly more like concentrated for like bosses, like doing high damage on a single foe. So, you know, that's also, of course, a good balance in terms of like depending on if you're fighting a big tanky enemy or, you know, numerous minion enemies, there are certain techniques that are better suited for certain situations. I mentioned earlier there is no strike/pierce system in the game like there have been in the most recent games. The system that sort of replaces that is a break damage versus HP damage system. Some enemies, and almost all bosses, if not all bosses, have like an armor value. It's denoted by little like gray little shieldy icons on an enemy's HP gauge, and you basically have to get rid of that before you can actually do damage. And there are certain skills that don't do a whole lot of HP damage, but do a lot more break damage. So again, when you're fighting a certain enemy, when you find a big guy who has an armor, you know, value, then you know, oh, okay, I should use these other skills primarily first to chip off their armor, and then go switch to my high damage HP skills to knock them out. So there's always a good balance, and previous games did this pretty well, did this well also, but in terms of like, We've been talking about how you're not just spamming the same skills over and over again. There are certain enemies, certain situations where you want to use certain skills or other skills. And as you're switching between Karja and Adel, you're always switching things up and you're always gaining new skills, like I mentioned. So the game is fresh and it never feels like it gets old. And it's just really, really fun. So
you had mentioned in your review some of the differences with Flash Step and Flash Guard.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was just curious if you could go into detail on those.
Yeah, I can. But my main takeaway is if you come primarily to East games for just fun combat, and that's like your main thing, then you will have a blast. This game is fun. It's
basically me too. I wasn't really big into Yeast storyline until Yeast 8, because most other Yeast games, I just could care less about the story most of the time, right?
And this game goes to no place. Like, I'd say that even with my issues with East 9, which are numerous, I'd say that East 9's story is really... The conclusion is pretty damn good. The stuff that it does with Adel is pretty cool. But, yeah.
My main issue with East 9, I know we're not reviewing East 9 here, is the reveal of the antagonist. it's
who?
I'm gonna try to say it generically, but it's like, oh my god, it's that guy. And you're like, wait, what guy? And the way it's presented didn't quite land for me.
It's because you fast traveled to the Dandelion Bar and you, yeah. Anyways, as for Flash Guard, Flash Dodge, or Flash Step, or whatever it's called, previous games, while the implementation changed a bit, there was this Flash Guard, Flash Dodge system where it was kind of easily abused, where if you dodged at the last moment or if you blocked at the last moment, I forget exactly what it was what, but one of them like raised your damage and one of them raised your critical rate, so you could do a bunch of critical attacks in a row and you get like a bullet time kind of slowdown going on. And I wasn't a huge fan of these systems. It got better in the later games, like 9, but it was still just not a system I really thought was a big strength of those games, where
it was mega abusable because you would flash dodge and then during the bullet time you the active hitbox of the enemy still can be flash blocked, so you can stack flash dodge, flash guard, and then indefinitely.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So this game doesn't have that at all. What it does have is certain enemy techniques. I think they're called like power attacks and speed attacks. I might have the naming bit off.
That's right. And then you have dual guard and then hash or speed attack. You just dash through it. It doesn't have any like terms for it.
Yeah. So when an enemy gained or like is enveloped in like a red aura, then they're about to do a power attack. And these attacks, you basically need to block them with good timing. And if you do that, then you oftentimes can perform a counter. And also, it raises something called a revenge gauge, which I actually haven't mentioned yet. And then some attacks, the enemy is enveloped in like a blue aura, and these auras you cannot block, but you can dodge them. And if you dodge them, it actually doesn't read your revenge counter, and most of the time doesn't have a counter, but it's still something you can dodge just by holding a button, basically. And so this is a weird comparison, but it is recent. This also makes me think of Reignatus in a weird way, only like a billion times better in terms of how it's implemented. Where the reason why it reminds me of Reignatus, if you remember my discussion a couple weeks ago, was there are certain attacks that you have to be observant in terms of like, oh, this enemy that I'm fighting is doing a power attack, I can only block it in a certain way with a duo block, or this enemy is doing a speed attack, I cannot block it, I have to dodge it. But I think East just does a better job balancing these and, you know, signing them ahead of time so you kind of know what you're doing, versus Reignatus just becomes a mess. But it's also those things that, you know, kind of force you to pay attention to what's going on in battle, where you can't just spam attacks and dodge roll and dodge roll and dodge roll all the time. There are certain attacks that you can dodge, certain attacks you have to block. Now, the revenge gauge. So every time you block an attack, you have a multiplier that goes up a little bit. It starts at 1.0 times, and then each time you block, it goes up to like 1.4, 1.7, 2.1, 2.4. By the end of the game, it can go all the way up to 5x. And basically how this system works, each time you block an attack, your revenge gauge goes up. And then when it's high enough to whatever you like, the next duo skill you use will basically be multiplied damage. Duo skills are what James mentioned a couple minutes ago, where rather than having working just Adel or just Karja, you hold the right trigger and you basically control both of them at the same time. And when you press the right trigger, you go into duo mode, which you are controlling Adel and Karja at the same time. You cannot really move in this mode. You can, just not very much. You're just kind of like slowly moving side to side. But what this allows you to do is it allows Adel and Karja to attack at the same time. And basically you can do a lot more damage this way. And you can use duo skills, which are those high-powered, high SP cost skills that James mentioned. But those are the skills that when you use them, they use your revenge gauge. So whatever your multiplier is set to, you can do a duo skill and it'll do huge damage. So this sort of works like a snowball rolling downhill, where in battle, you're fighting lots of enemies in a battle arena. You're fighting enemies, you're switching between Adel and Karja, you're building up your chain, and then every once in a while, it's worth it to block an attack here or there when you can, because you can raise your gauge. And your multiplier just, it how do I put this? It doesn't ever like diminish, not until you use it. So you can just keep building it. You don't have to worry about like it expiring or anything. You just build your gauge, and then once you've blocked enough attacks and your gauge is high, just unleash a duo skill and you do massive damage, and then you kind of start over. So there's this kind of nice ramp up and payoff each battle as you do this. And of course, in boss fights, this can be incredibly useful to doing massive amounts of damage. Speaking of boss fights, this game has some really fun bosses, like really dynamic, really high energy, sort of like chaotic, but in a good way kind of boss fights. I don't know if I want to say a whole lot more and spoil it. Like even not just story stuff, but even just like the types of boss encounters. There's some really cool ones.
Keep it at that. Yeah. I definitely want to see for myself, like just be surprised at what kind of bosses it has.
There are like some bosses like, okay, I played the game on nightmare mode. More on that in a second. Yeah. But it's a type of exciting battles where like it's exciting enough and you're into it in the moment. Like when you get that last hit in the boss, you kind of want to punch your fist in the air and say, fuck you, you know? Now, a lot of the boss fights have, like, this is where the game's visuals and new engine are a delight, in that a lot of the boss fights, when you perform your first counter on the boss, they're oftentimes accompanied with a very cinematic, choreographed, like, in-battle action sequence, which are really fun and really cool. And by the way, you can skip them. If you're like have to retry a boss and you've seen the action sequence once already, you don't need to sit through it every time. But it's still very cool. And it's just
in Yakuza, there's always like the in-game classic Yakuza cinematic, basically QTE, but fun to watch sort of sequences.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a bunch of those
different health checkpoints.
Mm-hmm. And they're really cool. I feel like there was something I was going to say. Oh, yeah, nightmare mode. So nightmare mode is hard. But one thing I actually really like about it is that you don't lose until Adel and Karja both go down. And how that works is if you're playing as Adel and you get hit and you lose all your health, the game will switch over to Karja, and if you can get over to Adel and revive him before you get hit, you'll basically, how it works is you basically take half of Karja's HP and give it to Adel, and then you're up and running again. And there was actually a handful of boss fights in the game where Adel would die, I would revive him, then Karja would die, and then I would revive her, and I'd get to the point where like each character had like only one health. But as long as
that for one of the bosses too.
Yeah, as long as you're able to like revive the other before they both go down. Sure, you can beat a boss with Adel and Karja both at one health. No problem.
You know what that reminds me of?
That's more than enough health in these games. As long as the value of your HP is above zero, then you're good to go.
As
MMO healers always tell you, the only hit point that matters is the last one.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it kind of reminds me of like those arcade beat them up games back in the day. It's like if your friend dies, it's like they take up one of your lives trying to revive. You know, it's like one of those kind of things, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me talk about a few things that I was a little bit less positive on. And so if you read my review, I gave it a 7. Because even though I really, really like the combat, I felt like there was a bunch of other things, littler things, that kind of just started to add up over time. That was just like, my fondness for this game is lopsided, in a way. First of all, the main exploration mechanic in this game is sailing. So you get a ship, and you're sailing this Obelia Gulf, and you're going from island to island. And I'll just be honest, this didn't really work for me at all, and it's kind of multifaceted. One, the ship traversal itself is kind of slow, especially starting out. It gets faster over time. There is that progression there. But it's kind of in stark contrast with the pace of the rest of the game. Whenever you have to go on your ship and like slowly travel the ocean from island to island, it's just kind of dull.
I'd say that by the end of the game, it feels really good, at least in my opinion. But it does itself no favors by having like the first area you have the ship in be super like wide open. And your ship is the slowest it'll ever be. You have the least amount of boosts. You have the slowest recharge for your boosts. And then, I don't know, it just feels like the game did not do it, like, give itself any favors with the ship stuff.
They should have put the bigger zone later when your ship is faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's also the ship combat in the game, which, I don't know... I haven't really played games like Black Flag or other naval combat games, so to be honest, I have a difficult time even knowing if I would ever like ship combat or what a good ship combat system would feel like or do, but I don't like the ship combat in East 10. It's basically you're shooting cannons at other enemy ships, and you kind of are like sailing around them. There is like a momentum factor where you can't just turn on a dime because you're a ship, right? So you kind of have to slowly arc around and try to get yourself in position, kind of doing pot shots on the way, right, trying to hit them. And these do moderate damage, but what you really want to do is get up next to the ship and do, like, your, like, full barrage ship to ship when you're, like, close to them on the side, and that does your real damage. And then later on, you get a couple of special weapons, like you get, like, ice cannonballs and, like, little slightly homing missiles and things like that. I don't know how that works. They're, like, magic homing missiles. But, I don't know, just this, none of this was exciting to me, and I felt like there was a lot, like, the number of ships that you have to take out is kind of more than I would like. It just kind of feels like it's too overstuffed with enemy ships, and then this also leads to the recapture battles. Do you remember in East 8, the island defense battles, and East 9 had the Grimwald Knight battles? Yeah. Those sort of come back here, and I didn't like those to begin with.
Yeah, I hated those things, but I think I hated them for a different reason in this one. I hate it because it takes like 10 minutes to get through it in this one.
Yes, that's actually exactly it. They take so long in this one, and they kind of felt like, I don't know, whenever I ran into one of those islands they had to recapture, they're kind of met with a sigh and an eye roll. I was like, oh, another one of these.
I hated them in East 8 for a different reason. I hated them because you're about to kill a boss and Dogi would call you, Idol, our town's in danger, get back here. like, oh shit, not this again.
Yeah, so those return, I wasn't a fan. And
I will say at least that, like, I feel like they're, yeah, they're long, but I feel like they're less intrusive in 10 versus like the ones in 8 and 9.
But I feel like it's just like the need for them. Like Falcon has like this like weird incessant need to, like, these days for East to have these sorts of like,
yeah,
which it doesn't really do the pacing of like what fans like or like what players like in general, right? But like people just want to have like, you know, like a very smooth sense of pacing where like these sorts of like inclusions of these systems, whether it's the tower defense of 8 or those Grimwald things from 9, it's like oh, you kind of just roll your eyes when they happen again. It's like, here we go again, you know, where you could kind of just not have them and to be totally fine, you know.
Okay, so the other facet to this that I mentioned is this world exploration in this game is islands on an ocean map, and especially in like the first maybe 70% of the game, many of the islands that you encounter and you basically land on and explore, they're kind of like bite-sized little explorable mini zones. And I wasn't really a big fan of this either. I know this was actually, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, one of James's criticisms when he did his import impressions a year ago, or rewind our podcast about 50 episodes or whatever to last year to hear James talk about this. A lot of the islands, not only do they kind of like look the same, first of all, the look, they, many, many, many islands look like tropical islands with sandy beaches and maybe short, green, small tufts of grass and some cliffs and rocks.
There's essentially four main biomes in this game. There's the island that has the grassy hills with trees.
Mm-hmm.
There's the island that has a bunch of sand and like rock bluffs. There's the random fortress on an island that's otherwise grassy hills and trees. And then there's the caves. And that's basically like 90% of what you're seeing in this game.
Yeah. And it kind of is unfortunate that just so many of the islands are just kind of like interchangeable and forgettable. And like I said before, for a while, the combat, like you go on the islands, you're fighting enemies, that's fun. It's just the exploration of the islands itself, they're just not visually interesting and they kind of blend together. But not only that, they're also just many of the islands are kind of like perfectly situated to be like a loop, like a visual, like you just kind of go from one end of the island to the other and you kind of like collect the things on the way.
It's like an octopath.
Yeah, it does feel like Octopath, where it's just kind of like go along the path and maybe there's a small dead end to pick up a chest or hit a crystal or whatever. And the game does catalog all of these. So it does have that kind of base collectible, you know, satisfaction, I guess, where you go to each island, you kind of check it off your checklist, like, yep, I got all the chests, I got all the collectibles, and that island is done. On to the next one. And you do the same thing. You do the same thing. Now, one of the things I liked about Ys 8 is I liked the exploration of that island, where you kind of start off like along the beaches of that island and you find a few of the paths that you can go on. But then as you progress further and further in the game, you see more and more how the paths connect, how you get like into the volcano and on the other side of the volcano into the ruins and things like that, and seeing how the paths loop around on themselves. And that was actually one of my favorite parts about Ys 10, was kind of the navigating around the island, the singular island. And then Ys 9, one of the things I didn't like about Ys 9 is it kind of felt a little bit more segmented in terms of like
way too focused on the central city, where it looked so like gray and brown, and you eventually get some areas that look different, but even then the overall like color palette is so much more subdued than Ys 8, which isn't a problem in and of itself, but there's not nearly enough, like even back then, like my main complaint with Ys 9 was there's not enough visual variety.
Yeah.
In some ways, Ys 10 is even worse.
Yeah, that's basically my point, is I kind of feel like Ys 10 is even more segmented, where you're just kind of going from like mini island to mini island most of the time.
I think the thing that really gets me is that the splash screen for the game on PS5, because again, I played it on PS5 because when I played it, Japanese launch, there was no PC version. Thankfully, the PS5 version is good, so whatever. Yeah. But the splash screen, the key art for Ys 10, let's see if I can find...
We might have it uploaded.
Ys 10 Nordics
splash. I mean, once again, there's an audio podcast, so...
Yeah, I'm just like... yeah, so there's a splash screen, like, key art for Ys 10 that you see whenever you boot the game up on PS5, and it has... This it shows the whale. It shows the whale, and it's like kind of like, yes, that one. There's an active volcano in that one.
I don't remember there's a volcano in the game.
We never visit an active volcano in the game. There's an active volcano in the key art, but we never visit any place that interesting in Ys 10 Nordics.
Now, the one exception to the game, I believe it's chapter 9, which I think is the second to last chapter, is, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's a temple area. And the temple area, it's pretty much the whole chapter, and it's actually, like, just different from everything else in the game. And it's cool.
Yeah.
But it's like the only area like that. The last chapter is a little different too, but I don't think it necessarily in a good way. But anyways, that was a big disappointment. Just kind of like the world exploration. Just not only the ship sailing and the ship combat, but the like the design of the islands and the visual variety and like the navigation. I was reading some other reviews of this game. My review is on the low end, but I wasn't the only one who gave it a 7. A couple other reviews were just basically saying like kind of when you're on your ship, you just kind of go from like one dot to another dot, and you're just like doing dot to dot to dot, and it's just kind of that's what it is.
I like connecting dots.
Okay. Yeah, but that didn't really work for me. I talked about the recapture battles. There are also a couple of other, I called them vestiges of East 8 and East 9 that appear in East 10. Despite doing a major overhaul of the combat system, you remember how in East 8 you're basically finding survivors to basically build your island camp, and in East 9 you basically recruit people to join you at the Dandelion Bar. And each of these NPCs has like a different,
function,
right, that they do. And here, that comes back in East 10 too. You have your ship, the Sandras, and you start out with a few characters, and you basically, as you explore islands, you do recruit other characters to your ship. And, you know, one of the characters makes food for you. One of them is a shop. One of them does like accessories. One of them, does like fishing stuff. There is fishing in this game. So that part is back. Now, it's fine.
You mentioning the fishing just reminded me of the funniest moment in East 10 in the side quest, where it's like you see the fish getting like harassed by sharks or something.
Anyways,
I like the idea on paper of like filling out a pirate crew. Like, yeah, I want to create a new crew, but it's just in a series that's already
done it before. Well.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That is one part of it. It kind of feels like East 10 is fresh and new, but here's some stuff from the previous two games. Like, oh, okay. This again. Like, literally. But also, it's like, this again.
Like, I don't want every game in a series to have to reinvent itself fully, but it's like, it's pulling something from other games in the series that is fine, not like, you know, take it or leave it. It's not like, oh, this is super emblematic of what I want a East game to be. It's like, no.
There were East games that didn't have this, you know, you didn't have to recruit and do a new crew. Like, it's not right. Like Falcom is like totally forgot that, like, you know, how to make a East game. Like, I think it's just like, I think it feels like they have a weird attachment to like how how East is formalized right now. Yeah.
I mean, I get it, because East 8 is probably the most, like, beloved Falcom game at this point, like, overall. And I would say that, like, as annoying as, like, so many of these features, like, coming back, as annoying as that is, like, I loved the, like, building up, like, Castaway Village in 8. I thought that was, like, one of the highlights of that game.
I think it's cool, but it doesn't mean that every fucking game.
Yeah, didn't
it?
Yeah.
No, that I'm with you.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
It's just like I can understand why maybe they're hesitant to move away from it, even if honestly it just reads as them being like, what's the best way of putting it? Insecure about the new features in East 10. I don't know.
As for the characters themselves, in my review, I was deciding how do I describe these characters, and I said they are fine. They are fine. One of the characters who you probably hear most is Gren. Gren is like a very enthusiastic young man, and he's kind of like very, very eager and over the top. Another character that is mildly amusing is Mirabelle. She's a little bit older than the other children, and she's like extremely composed, in a way, which is kind of amusing. Legitimately, one of my characters that I would say is probably my favorite is I liked the lighthouse keeper and his daughter. How the characters work, and this is also brought over from the Modern Trails series, is you do have a notebook for the characters, and if you do certain events for them and you talk to them, and you can fill out your notebook with your like character entries. This should sound very familiar if you played any Trails game recently. Once you do that, you kind of get like a little mini backstory for each character. And most of them to me were kind of like cookie cutter, forgettable. They're not necessarily bad. They're just kind of like fine. But I did think the lighthouse one was actually like modestly neat or moderately neat. But this isn't a strength of the game for me. It's just kind of fine, and it's there.
Also, I don't know how you felt about it, but there's a certain like dynamic between two characters in particular that's very much a demerit to me, because it's like, come on.
Is this the Raph one that Chow talked about, I think, prior to the podcast? It's
the one between the, very, very minor spoilers, between the one dude that absolutely hates his deadbeat father.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Chow was talking about this before we started recording. It's kind of weird. It's
not good.
Oh, yeah.
It's not good.
Well, I can't really explain without spoilers, but yeah.
Yeah. If you can't, then that's, yeah, that let's leave it there.
Okay. There are other mechanics in the game that I haven't mentioned, like the release line system. The release line system, I can kind of take it or leave it. I honestly, maybe I'm just lazy, but I actually went through most of the game not touching it. I was just like, this is boring. I don't want to slot in gems here.
I don't know about you.
It's a node. It's like a sphere grid, only it's linear. And you get these nodes that you can slot gems in, and they raise your stats minorly. And there's kind of a color coordination system that comes into play, where if you place lots of reds together, they can create a bonus. Or you put lots of yellows together, they create a different bonus.
It's basically very, very, very similar to the Trails in the Sky word mint system.
Only not as interesting or good.
Yeah.
It's pretty dumbed down. But I was going to say, like, in the game journalist copy or the reviewer's copy, it has every DLC. So like, we got all the rainbow mass seeds to start.
Wait, I didn't.
Hey, my version did. Wait. I opened all these DLCs, like, oh, it's like, nope, rainbow DLC.
Cheater DLC not really reflected.
Was this like, did I have to like go in the menu and redeem these somewhere? I never did.
Yeah, it's in your inventory. It's like,
I never did.
I think when I played East 10, I also had that DLC because of the code from Falcom, but because I played it on my North American PSN, I didn't have access to it.
Oh, right.
Falcom knows that I'm bad at their games, so they gotta give me all their DLCs, okay? Game journalist mode.
That reminds me of how like I'm playing through Kai no Kiseki now, and I got the limited edition, so I have all like the like OST stuff. But I started the game on my North American account anyways without thinking, and now I'm too far in where it's like, well, I guess if I ever replay this, I'll have the DLC, I guess.
Adam, how is the OST for East? Because usually it's pretty,
it's good. It's better than the previous games. I think there's less Singa, which is good news for Chow.
You know, it's
there's also less Singa and Kai no Kiseki. And honestly, a lot of his songs, honestly,
I can already tell what song it is. It's a mid boss theme. They always use them for the trash mid boss theme.
I'll say that it does seem like between East 10 and Kai that he's doing a little bit better recently. Not by much, but there's some songs in like the Kai no Kiseki soundtrack where it's like, oh shit, this is probably his best work. Like, I have no complaints about it. You know it's good when you go on the Falcom music channel and the resident Singa haters like reply to this one Singa song. It's like, you know what? Shit. I'll give you this one.
There is an area theme early on that sounds like, I don't know if it's maybe just a similar sound or if it's meant to be intentional. It sounds like Adol's theme in earlier games. I'm trying to remember what his theme is called. Is it called like That Boy with Wings? Something like that? Or is that a different one?
Yeah. No, I remember the song. I'm trying to find it because I was going to say that that's probably my favorite song in the soundtrack, just because of how like incredible it is.
Yeah, and if you played earlier East games, there's a nostalgic there because I'm pretty sure it's supposed to intentionally sound like that, and it kind of fits with this actually being kind of Adol's first adventure outside of East. And like I said, as far as the story goes, basically Adol is, 17 years old and just did the events of East, and basically he's just starting out. So he's not, in later games, he's like this kind of legendary adventurer, but he's definitely not here.
Was it this song?
One second.
We'll have to pipe it in here or something.
Well, like actually, that. I think the way the podcast recording works, I think this will actually capture in the recording. Let's test it here.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's this one. Yeah, this sounds like Adol's theme to me in earlier games.
Yeah, easily it's the best song in the soundtrack. Close second would be the second final boss theme, I think. Which is
I'm just letting it play for a while because I enjoy it. All right. So yeah, that was the theme I was thinking of, actually. So we were thinking of the same one. Okay. I think that's about it for... Oh, I guess to finalize thoughts on the release line system. So how the release line works is it kind of like slowly opens up as you like progress through your levels. Like when you gain levels, you get more and more nodes. Maybe I'm just lazy, but I actually spent large swaths of the game just ignoring it. And then when I got to the very like end, I was like, okay, I should actually probably like put some thought into this. And I just... At that point, I had a bunch of crystals that you collect and a bunch of the currency you use to create these gems. And I finally decided to do some color coordination and do it. But it was, I don't know, I was kind of take it or leave it. It's not a super interesting system. Okay. I can't really talk about this without spoiling, so I kind of have to be vague. The storyline itself also didn't really work for me. I won't spoil anything, I promise. It does do that thing that East 8 and East 9 did, where it kind of feels like 80% of the narrative takes place in the last 20% of the game. It spends a lot of time ramping up to that. And there were just a handful of times in the narrative where I kind of felt like it was building a stake. It was building stakes. And then it kind of just like muted them at the last moment where it just kind of like, well, never mind. Those stakes we thought were coming, forget about them. It didn't really matter. And that happened, I can think of three times on the top of my head. I won't say anything, but it was just kind of like deflating each time. Where I was just like, man, that's all that led to was that. So, and then at the very end of the game, there is a theme that they try to bring to the forefront, but this didn't really work for me either in terms of just like a thematic kind of through line. And it's not necessarily like, you know, like poor, it's just kind of bland. So
it's just conventional, I think that's the way
it's a little bit typical. And so now, if, like I said, like if you're someone like Josh, you're not really coming to East for the story, it's like, oh, it's fine. It's a vehicle for the gameplay. It's just there to give you a reason to fight things in the cool combat system.
Yeah.
But it is something that I kind of wish was just something that I latched onto a little bit more strongly, was the actual front-to-back narrative, but I didn't.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why 8 is a little bit more better received, because it did manage to some extent land a little better on that front.
Okay.
And obviously it's all personal opinion, but yeah.
Okay. Now, maybe we can do a spoiler talk later, but because unfortunately it's hard to talk about your qualms and the things you like without spoiling. Anyways.
Well, we'll inevitably get to it with
the game of the year discussion. Sure. Okay. So I said when I started this section, I was going to wrap around to another thing I liked at the end. I ended on a high note. The dynamic between Adol and Karja is extremely, extremely good. And it's honestly like my favorite type of character interaction possible. So at the beginning of the game, basically Karja is the pirate princess. She is, like I talked about the Normans basically being this sort of pirate, you know, I guess tribe that navigates these waters, and they're the law. They what they say goes, and you kind of have to acquiesce to them. And so she's the pirate princess, and so she's not a very friendly person, and, you know, people are sort of intimidated by her and whatnot.
That's a bit understating it. I think since it's like the very beginning of the game, we can just say what she does. We can just say that she...
I mean, yeah, like if this is going to spoil the story, then I don't want to hear it.
No, it's literally like first five minutes.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Kills this like person,
literally the very first interaction you have of Karja is she fucking kills someone.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's a ship that basically violates their like sea trade routes, and they're like, well, this is your punishment, and they kill the captain. So anyways, so early on in the game, Adol and Karja mysteriously get like tied together with like a string, like a magic rope string thing. And they literally cannot leave each other's side. Like, they have to be within, like, 10 or 15 feet of each other. And, of course, it sort of starts off with, like, this is terrible. This is, like, the worst thing that could happen to me or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And how do we get rid of this? But the game doesn't linger on that for too long. She kind of accepts it. And Adol, of course, doesn't talk, or at least doesn't talk much. So Karja basically becomes the de facto main character of this game. In English, she's voiced by Cherry Millet, who, if you played Japanese RPGs in English, you recognize Cherry Millet as the voice of Makoto. She's the voice of, I guess, not a JRPG, but she's the voice of Female V in Cyberpunk and a bunch of other stuff.
Asuna from Sora Online. This is the Sora Online cast right here. You're gonna price
it's Asuna and Kirito. Okay. I didn't actually think about it that way, but it is in English. Because Bryce Baffenbrook is Adol and he's also Kirito. But anyways, it doesn't linger on this sort of like sourpuss, you know, oh, I can't believe I'm tied together with this guy for too long. They kind of like accept it. And as you go through the game, they basically form like a belief in each other and a bond in each other. And maybe like 20% of the way through the game, they actually do this like trial where they become Shield Brother and Shield Sister. And this is sort of a ritual that the Normans have relatively early on in the game. And it's a ritual that the Normans have to basically allow them to, I guess, kind of like their rite of passage into adulthood. And basically from that point on, they're like a pair. They're a duo. They're partners. And you really kind of feel it in the game. Now, I have to admit, it is not perfectly reciprocal because Karja talks and Adol doesn't really talk, but you can kind of see it in like mannerisms. You can see it in like the cinematic action sequences that I mentioned earlier between Adol and Karja in the boss fights. And basically,
random question.
Go
did
ahead.
Did you see the thing in the epilogue?
The thing in the epilogue.
The was it the mana stone at the end?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Black mana stone. You saw that then? So yeah. So it's like even outside like the cutscene stuff, like you do genuinely get like direct confirmation just how like strong their bond is by the end. So
yeah. So basically, by the end of the game, you really feel like these two characters would take a bullet for each other. They like have ultimate faith in each other, belief in each other. There's no doubts anywhere, like between the two, like there's this trust, and it's honestly like my favorite sort of relationship. Gender doesn't really matter, but I think it's the fact between a man and a woman, and especially in the Yeast series, where oftentimes the female protagonist is like a damsel or kind of falls head over heels for Adol or whatnot in a more typical fashion.
Or secretly a deity. Maybe evil or maybe good. I don't know.
But here it feels more even keel, where Adol is not like a legendary adventurer and your female character isn't just like a damsel or whatever. They feel like they're on even footing and it just works extremely well. And it's not like I put in my review, it doesn't feel like a romance. It doesn't feel like a friendship. It's more than that. It's like this kinship that feels like by the end of the game, it's unbreakable.
It feels like they're true siblings. How's that? In my opinion.
Yeah.
It's like, I think my favorite kind of interactions, like when you get a treasure map, Adol is like so excited to go find treasure and she looks kind of like annoyed. And if you find a treasure, you know, she gets kind of like even more annoyed because, oh, damn, I guess you're right, you know, kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. So like, oh, no, this is going to encourage him.
That's like my favorite interaction with the two, so.
Yeah, it kind of gets to the point where you feel like if Adol talked that Karja could finish his sentences. But yeah, it's just like my... I was kind of worried that it would become more typical as the game goes on, where like, I don't know, Adol would have to save Karja or something. I guess that I don't want to spoil anything, but you know, it does a good job with these two characters, and it's a highlight. And it's also the type of relationship you don't really see a whole lot, so it's just kind of refreshing in that way too.
Also, it's just kind of like, I think of the party members in 8 and 9, and a lot of them are pretty forgettable. There are some pretty good ones. Like, I like Dahl from 9, and I like Hummel from 8. But, like, a lot of the other ones are kind of like Laxia from 8, and some.
I only remember Hummel from 8 because I spammed his counter for, like, I don't know. Once I got countered,
what was the name of the child party member from 8?
Ricola?
Yeah, Ricola. The only thing I really remember about her is when they in the credits roll, where they're like, yeah,
they went missing.
Her and her father have never seen again. It's like, Jesus, game.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, Sorry, go ahead.
Go for it, Joe.
Oh, I'm just saying, I love, Yusei's story a lot, but I really hate that ending. I think the ending kind of sours me a bit about the game. I'm not sure if there's any games that you would feel that way, where it ended kind of sour your entire
Lost experience. Odyssey. Sorry, that's just what came to mind.
Sea of Stars.
Oh, that's out.
Okay, well, go ahead, Josh.
Because we're kind of winding down from East 10. I guess my question to you, Adam, is what would you like to see in the next East entry based on the advancements that they made with East 10?
So the combat system, it's one of those things where it's I don't necessarily want to see this combat system again. Not because I loved it, but I don't want them to just here it is again with no, significant changes or alterations. But primarily, I want exploration to be more meaningful, a reason to what's over there, what's over here, and basically the structure around the combat in terms of where you're going and what you decide to do and where you decide to go. Or this game, it is you kind of do that on the ocean with your ship on these little segmented islands, but it's just kind of. It feels
better than East 9, but just barely.
Here's a trickier question. When was the last East game for you that you felt exploration was super rewarding or meaningful?
Well, like I said, I liked it in 8 with the island. And yeah. I mean, I know earlier games are much shorter and they're more interconnecting zones.
I'd say that the only two East games that really kind of nailed exploration are East 8 and East 6, pretty much. And even E6, it's less of a thing nowadays because if you're playing E6 now, you're going to use the fast travel. But when the original version of E6 did not have fast travel.
Mm-hmm. So, didn't even know the game had fast travel.
It was something that XSEED added in with their version. So
I only played in Japanese. I actually never fully viewed in English from what I remember.
I actually remember Brian years and years and years ago playing the Konami PS2 version.
The 3D splits. The shitty CGI cutscenes.
Yep.
Yeah. I enjoyed the hell of it. It was just pretty ugly. It was just ugly.
I think the weirdest thing with the Konami version is, you use a cheat code if you want to unlock Japanese voices. I don't know why would you put a cheat code to do that. So, I guess that's a thing.
I don't even remember it having voices. Maybe little chirps. But, so long story short, I really love the combat. Karja is great. I love the dynamic between him and Adol, especially, or her and Adol, especially. There's just a lot of other things that kind of piled up that I mentioned in that kind of dilute it. But I do think the combat is strong enough to hold its own. So,
I guess the last thing is, and this is. Maybe goes without saying, but we'll still give you an opportunity to talk about it. Thoughts on the PC port?
Oh, I even put this in my review. I probably shouldn't, but I almost take it for granted. Where it's this is an NIS America port done by PH3, Durante.
Yeah.
And it's excellent. No issues.
I do not think it's an exaggeration to say that as of right now, if it's a Falcom game, therefore it's being the PC port is being handled by Durante, that's going to be the best PC version of a game released that year.
Yeah.
With the current state of PC ports, that's a given.
So what's going to happen with the Cloud Leopard version?
They updated it, and actually there's something really fascinating about that. The Clouded Leopard version of East 10 has DLSS, XeSS, and FSR, which is interesting because originally East 10 does not have TAA. It does not have the motion vectors for it. So from a technical standpoint, it wasn't able to support it. And I was wondering, how did they get it supported then? Did they add it in themselves or something like that? Well, I don't know if Josh said anything about it or Chow said anything about it, because I know you guys talked about Kaino Kiseki a few weeks ago, right? Something like that.
But we didn't really talk about the technical state of it.
Yeah. So I finished up Kuro 2 and I immediately started up Kai this week. And immediately one thing I noticed is that Falcom's engine now supports TAA. So I'm assuming that the reason why the Cloud and Leopard East 10 PC port has DLSS and whatnot it's because they probably got an updated version of the engine from Falcom in order to implement it, which is fascinating, actually. But yeah, a little bit of a tangent there, but figure it was interesting.
I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, but we actually did interview, or Mikhail did, Durante, about the PC port. And one thing I didn't get to mess with, for example, Durante has added this in previous games, but there is like a co-op mode that he kind of like, how do I put this? He kind of puts it into the game. It's not like official because it's not like a Falcom co-op mode, but Durante puts it in anyway.
Feature, yeah. He likes to do it.
Now, I'm actually not sure how that really works with this game being, because other games, obviously you have multiple characters that you can use simultaneously, but in this game, I'm not sure how that would affect how the combat works. Especially with like duo mode, but that's in there.
Yeah, on the Steam page, he put up like a little clip of the game of like it running two player mode.
Okay,
there's like a YouTube.
There's also a demo you can play right now.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised. I didn't try out the demo, but I was talking to some people about it. It's a pretty meaty demo. It's like around a 6 hour demo from the beginning of the game that supports like save data transfer to the full game. So I was like, oh, that's a lot of game.
I heard the demo goes up to chapter 3. So that's pretty long.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that NAS America announced that the demo has like save data transfer, and I was actually just thinking you had to get through quite a bit of the game before like the early sections of the game, like as usual, is pretty narrative heavy, a lot of events and scenes and stuff, and it takes a while before you actually get to like the gameplay. So it's even just on that, it's got to be a pretty lengthy demo.
Yeah, Falcom games have been for a while now been getting pretty like ridiculously sized demos. Like Trails Through Daybreak's demo, I never played it, but that demo goes through the ending of chapter 1. That's like 10 hours a game.
I didn't even know that was that long, that demo.
Well, I think what's weird is like I think the Switch version has a little bit shorter demo. The PlayStation, the PC version, you get like a... No, not the PC version. The PlayStation gets a longer demo for some stupid reason. So there's that.
For this game?
No, for Kai. Oh, not Kai, okay. Daybreak, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Weird. Like, asking Colin for screenshots, and he's like, wait a minute. It's like, my demo ends right here. It's like,
oh, that's funny. So that's how you guys realized it.
Yeah.
I guess maybe different platforms have different like limits or rules or restrictions on demo size or length.
But yeah, definitely give out like, you know, just a shout out to like, you know, the features that Mikhail's put up for East 10 along with your review. Like, you know, like the Durante interview that Mikhail had was really, really insightful. Just like,
honestly,
it gets to the really nitty gritty of like what the Durante's company and his process, their process. Like, even had to Durante had to like thank you, Nisa, for letting him allow him to speak in that depth. Because some of this like was like kind of shaky, like, oh, is this NDA or not? You know?
Yeah. I honestly, shout outs to Mikhail in general, because he's been like killing it since he's joined the last couple weeks. So
how do I put this? Well, anyways, just thank you, Mikhail. I know you're probably listening to this.
So definitely, you know, just both you and Mikhail killed it for East 10, and you know, I everyone has a choice to make now in terms of RPGs, because East 10 and like the Romantic Saga 2 remake, you know, come out on the same day pretty much. It's like, well, what are you gonna prioritize first?
Thank God I don't have to choose. I'm gonna play Sonic the Hedgehog.
There you go. So I don't know yet. I'm probably gonna do RS2 first, then East 10, but maybe I'll just do both and hate myself for it.
I just need to make sure I finish up Kaino Kiseki before Romancing Saga 2 hits.
I'm just trying to work my way through Metaphor.
There you go.
I haven't even started Metaphor because of stuff like this.
You have to start Final Fantasy 16.
Yeah.
Brian, I saw your comment on my follower or 100% guy thing. Thank you for responding to that person in the comments. I just saw that earlier.
Yeah, Josh put up a 100% followers guide for Metaphor, and as I've been playing through it, I've just been tweaking is too strong a word, just like adding some clarifying language.
Yeah, thank you.
If you say speak to suspicious person, I'll say like on the bridge. Like I've just making little tiny tweaks just to make it as QCing it, and it's a really good guide, and it's gotten me up through like the fourth dungeon with really high social ranks and archetype ranks.
Well, one sentence, you don't have to go too deep, but just like just one sentence, what are your thoughts so far?
I am liking it a lot. I will say that I've been focusing my main character as like a physical, but still specced into the mage archetypes just so I had access to those skills to exploit weaknesses. I'm like, when am I going to get someone that actually is like stat aligned to be a mage? And you finally get one at like that fourth dungeon time. I'm like, there, finally, someone I can like specialize into the magic stat.
It is a really weird, like, kind of like your first like two, like 3 to 4 party members are like very physical heavy aligned. So it is a weird cadence.
Yes. So I'm reading the latest comment. It says, "Will this guide allow you to win a debate against all the other candidates and allow you to complete all the other achievements?" Does that, Josh? You wrote this guide.
I mean, not that it doesn't do all the debates. I made it clear what it 100% and what it doesn't at the intro. Mm-hmm. So, but they do have a debate guide up that Cullen and Junior have worked on. But I mean, you know, you can be flexible with it too. Not like a ironclad. But yeah, so I mean that was East 10 Nordics. That was cool. Can't wait to
Nordiques.
I don't know how you pronounce it. Is it Nordics? Nordiques?
No, it's Nordics. I was joking earlier in the podcast, like earlier this year, I kept saying Nordiques as if I'm Canadian.
Not the stupid hockey team that went bankrupt and became Colorado Avalanche.
Just real quickly before we get onto the news here, I've been checking out, you know, the Steam Next Fest. Whenever these events come up on Steam, they have like thousands upon thousands of like demos for indie games and other games. I mean, there's like, you know, around the same time frame. It's not just indie games, but like East 10, for example, came up around that same time frame of these demos. And of course, it's not part of technically not a part of it, but like Square Enix's Romantic Saga 2 remake has had a demo out for a few weeks now. So forth. But I just wanted to take a quick peek and see, you know, some of like the smaller, cooler games that might be coming out. I tried out some that I want to shout out is AI Limit is a pretty interesting Souls-like indie game coming out. If you like Code Vein, you might actually like that game because it shares a lot of the same design philosophies and cadence that Code Vein does in that game, where there's like you have a sync rate as part of like your as part of the system, where you can like use like kind of sort of like quote unquote magic spells or techniques. Like you get a rail gun early on that consumes this sync rate, and other weapons have like their weapon exclusive like techniques. And the sync rate is an interesting like kind of balancing mechanic where you gain sync based on like landing light attacks and heavy attacks. And so, and then every time you use an ability, it turns down that sync rate. And the lower that you have it, the less damage that you do. So you kind of want to keep it high, but also not too high that you're just relying on basic attacks, because your techniques and spells are very useful as well. And if you get it all the way down to zero, you'll be like in a stun state. So you don't want to do that too. So there's like an interesting balance mechanic with that sync rate. And it's very reminiscent of like some of the systems that Code Vein handles it. And other demos that were pretty interesting was Voin, V-O-I-N, all in caps. It's like a first-person RPG, a very like demonic medieval fantasy, where you're primarily armed with a sword, and as you're going up against like, you know, creatures like skeletons, undead, you know, demons and so forth.
I think I described it as like Mordhau, only 3-edgy 5-me.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yes. And like, as like when an enemy is about to attack you, like glow yellow, so you have a chance to like perfect dodge it and then like encounter. And the interesting thing about the pace of combat in this game is like you heal by dealing damage and you heal more by landing heavy attacks. So like you're definitely encouraged to play aggressively, especially when you want to heal, and then you'll gain like spells through like building up runes by landing attacks, and then you can like unleash like a lightning spell by like landing a heavy attack that does like a chain lightning and so forth. And then you get like, you know, more loot as the enemies drop them, and then different weapons and equipment have like different modifiers, like if you attack from a certain like way or beat up a certain amount of enemies at this time frame, you'll like gain like bonuses to like your attack and so forth. So it's a pretty cool like fast paced action RPG. That's Voin. Other ones that I liked was Spirit of the Samurai, which is, it's more of a side-scroller action game. It does have some light RPG mechanics where you level up as you, you know, beat up enemies and, you know, you gain stats and then you learn new moves. But the really a standout part of this game is its look, its visuals. It's like it's animated in a very stop motion sort of way, and then like the models are almost like claymation. So it has a very unique look to it. And also the combat mechanics are pretty interesting, where you just don't have a standard attack button as your only option. You can actually like swing like the right stick up, down, to the other side to affect what sorts of move other sword moves that you do. And then as you're leveling up, you acquire new moves that can slot into these combos. So you can like kind of do like a create a combo in between each like sort of like square attack string, the flicking the right stick up, flicking the right stick down. And so forth. So that's a pretty cool like
sounds fun
indie game. Yeah, that's like, Spirit of the Samurai. Yeah, definitely. It's like, you know, the Steam Next Fest is up for like two more days, but you know, it's that has a pretty interesting demo. And I think that's it for like RPGs and stuff. There's other ones that I checked out. Was like, there's like this new indie creates game called like Divine Dynamo something something, where it's like it's a more 90s era RPG. I don't think it had like the best demo because it only showcased one character, and the game felt basic because of only being able to mess out with one character instead of like, it's hinting that there are other multiple characters that you can choose, but it's like that overhead Zelda perspective, and you can you know, swing a sword, cast a magic spell, and then like the interesting thing is like during like boss fights, it's almost like Magic Knight Ray Earth, where like you have like this familiar that can transform into like a giant robot. So during boss fights, you get into that mech, and then it's like it turns to a first person perspective from that mech cockpit.
So I'm just thinking of like Mystical Ninja Goemon. Have you played that?
It's I would say it's a little bit more basic than that, but I think I don't think the demo is like, it doesn't showcase what its potential, I guess, because you can only play one character in that. I also made a terrible mistake because Bandai Namco put up a demo for that new Taiko no Tatsujin game on Steam, and I was like, okay, let's see how like the PC performance is, and like it played really, really well and was very responsive. And then immediately after I got done playing that demo, I was like, I went to Amazon and like started looking at like really overpriced Taiko drum controllers. And I was like, oh man. So and then like I started thinking about like, oh man, when this comes out, should I get like the super expensive edition or not? Because it's kind of an interesting model that they're bringing to that game, where you can actually pay a subscription fee for access to like their extended library on top of like all the songs that comes with the full game. There's also like an extended library from that subscription fee that has like hundreds and hundreds of songs, but since a good chunk of them are licenses, like for like anime licensed music, like they come and go on that subscription, I think.
Yeah, that sounds kind of awful.
I mean, but it's like it's one of those things that like it's the only way they can viably do this, because the other way they can do this is like, I don't know how extensive this is, but I was looking into it, but there are some songs that you can purchase, but I don't know if you can purchase all of those songs, but it's not like, but I don't want to like purchase each song for $1 on that subscription fee, and there's like 700 songs, right? It's like, okay, like here, just fork over $700 then, you know, I'd rather pay like $5 a month, and then just for that month, say, hey, I just feel like playing a lot of Taiko no Tatsujin for that month, and then cancel that sub. And then come back whenever. So it's kind of a weird thing. I'd have to like search it up more and see like what the pricing model is like, and what sorts of like how long are songs actually in that subscription service before they're taken off. So it's kind of an interesting but weird model. It's unconventional, but it might make sense. I'm not sure. Other than that, I mean, there's other interesting games there. that I haven't tried out yet. Like, I know there's this game called Keep Driving that's like a car RPG. It's not like that Lagoon game from Square Enix. It's like a side-scroller car RPG. I think it has some sort of like deck-building mechanics to it that I have to try out, but had a really, really cool trailer when they announced it. And I think that's it for now in terms of like demos that I wanted to shout out. Like, those were the interesting ones. There were other ones that I didn't get a good sense for. Like, there was like an RPG that we reported on months ago called New Arcline that had a pretty cool, interesting CG trailer. But the demo for it is kind of rough because it's like very unoptimized. So even on high-end systems, you'll experience performance problems. So I think there's just like a little too early right now to kind of get a sense of what it's going for. And yeah, you know, I always just like checking out like new interesting stuff on Steam Next Fest and seeing like what should I keep an eye for. Just I try to give everything a shot, like, you know, as much as I can a shot.
No, you've always been really good regular at making sure we get a look in at all of these upcoming, typically indie projects in the RPG space that are made available through the Steam's Next Fest demo, which is, of course, a very cool endeavor that Steam's been supporting for years. But sometimes there's just so many options that you need a little bit of a curation to know what's worth looking at and what's kind of the more interesting highlights of the set. And with that, thank you, Adam, and others like Chow and James for going over very in-depth the upcoming release of East 10, and then Josh for the demos of the Steam Next Fest available right now. And we'll go into the news section. Not a whole lot here, but a few interesting titles, so we'll just kind of roll on through this. We did get a small update for the upcoming Clair Obscur Expedition 33. This is the Western JRPG-inspired game from debut project from Sandfall Interactive. It kind of made a big splash earlier this year when it was revealed during the summer gaming festivities. What we got this week was the release of the full voice cast. So some of this we kind of knew from the initial trailers, like Ben Starr. But then the cast here has a few kind of highlights in it. They've got Jennifer English, who voiced Shadowheart in Baldur's Gate 3. And then there's also Andy Serkis voices a character in this game, which is, you know, Gollum, Smeagol in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, things like that. And then also one thing that kind of came up in the news in a sort of interesting way is that Clair Obscur Expedition 33 did start showing up in a few shop lists. I forget if it was PlayStation Store or what, but priced at $50. And some people, like, the way that was covered in some cases is like, oh, is this an indie project? Is this a AA project? Like, what is this? And the developers did say, like, yep, this is our debut project. We are, you know, we're a small team, but we're ambitious in scope. But that is correct. And that's kind of what we're looking to hit, a 30-hour RPG. Like, they basically just kind of said, like, yep, that is intentional. That is what we want to do. We want to get as many people playing this as possible. And that's where we're deciding to price our game at. So that did also crop up this week.
Yeah, they're saying, you know, like, it's not gonna be like a super huge, like, 60 plus hour extensive RPG. They're trying to keep expectations and their scope in check. They're just saying, you know, we're aiming for, like, you know, 30 plus hours out of this project. And, you know, I always respect when developers, like, you know, are very upfront and transparent about, like, you know, their scope to their audience, and also, like, not try to, like, bloat it in like really, really ambitious ways. Like, oh, can you really, really do this with, like, the capacity of what you're able to do right now. Of course, there's always opportunity for growth if it's a successful project, but, you know, as for a debut project, you should definitely work within your means.
So, it's almost like a, I don't know if self-fulfilling prophecy is the right word, but, like, the you see the price at $50, and instead of saying, like, hell yeah, it's like, what's the catch? It's like, there is no catch.
That's kind of like a really depressing reaction, because I see $50, I'm like, oh, cool. It's like less than like the MSRP. But I know, understandably, other people are like, wait a minute, what's the catch here?
This is showing my age a little bit, but Super Mario Galaxy was $50. Like, yeah. I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's cool to see, like, you know, more news of this game, more new footage. It was really, really cool to see, like, you know, someone as, like, you know, obviously if you're talking about Andy Serkis, but also like someone like Charlie Cox is like involved in this project. Like, you know, a lot of people love his role as Matt Murdock in the like the Daredevil. So that's like,
I guess I didn't call that one out because I hadn't seen Daredevil.
Yeah. I really liked the, at least like the first two seasons of Daredevil when I watched them years ago. Like, he was really, really good.
This next one, Adam, I'm honestly struggling to know what to say about this. So we got a new trailer for the upcoming game Exodus. Exodus was first shown off, I think, during the Game Awards last year. And it's basically, Adam describes this one as not Mass Effect. It has a very kind of similar vibe as Mass Effect in terms of like visual stylings. But what we have seen from this game has primarily been like concept art, cinematic trailers, and a few snippets of gameplay. And the most recent trailer is kind of in the same vein. I don't know if you had the same takeaway when you saw this Maruyama reveal trailer.
Okay, so Exodus is revealed at the Game Awards last year. If you don't remember, it's the game that Matthew McConaughey came up and introduced it on stage.
Oh, right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yep. That one. It's like they kind of lean on that. Like, oh, yeah, this is the game that Matthew McConaughey introduced. But not only introduced, he's apparently in it. Like, he's a voice, he's a character. And he's also the voice in this trailer. Admittedly, for Exodus, I have a hard time like caring a whole lot about it because they have barely shown anything about it in terms of what it actually looks like to play it. It's been almost a year since it's been announced, but like they've shown like three different cinematic trailers. They have a bunch of like lore on the website, a bunch of concept art. And I know like you have to start with concept art, but they still haven't. I think there's like about 5 to 10 seconds of gameplay footage in the initial trailer, and that's about it.
There's a really funny thing to like bring up right after a story about Clear Obscur, where like the debut trailer of it had gameplay footage right away, and like you know what the game looks like, you know what the game generally will play like, right? And then like it was revealed,
and just, they followed up with a straight up gameplay vertical slice.
Yeah, so, meanwhile, compared to this project is still a big question mark. Like, you know, I would generally think that like if you're gonna promote a video game, at you know, you would want to like communicate to audiences this is what the game looks like when you're playing it. But I know this is like just a weird, you know, not every studio, not every marketing campaign does that, but for me, I'm just like, to me it makes sense personally.
Well, and like we do know that more often true in the indie space, like developers do sometimes listen to this podcast. So I don't want to just like, I want to give it as much like leash as possible, like take the most optimistic point of view. But I'm just not sure, like maybe I'm just not the target audience to see this trailer about the Maruyama enigmatic Starforge and be like, hell yeah, I want to play that.
But think about it, we're almost at the 1 year anniversary of when this project of when Exodus was revealed. And they have, you still don't know what the fuck it is in terms of like game. you're only taking them at a word that it's a video game, but everything they've shown off, it's hard to like envision that it's a game because you don't know, they've released nothing in terms of like how you play this game. What is this game? What, like, how do you play it? I don't know. It's been a year.
Yeah, I guess the word I was looking for was charitable. Like, I want to be as charitable as possible, but I agree with you. I'm just like, I don't know if I'm interested because there's not enough to make a determination on.
Anyways, the Maruyama, to be charitable, this trailer shows like, it's like a ship, but it's like a ship in space that's full of like, it's like a massive biomass heads and
it's a massive tumor.
Yeah, like the Maruyama is, they're going for like a horror vibe here, I guess, like space horror, where there's like these things in space that are like literally like masses of faces and bodies and mass horror and tumors and reaches out to the into space, and that's it. That's the Maruyama.
Not much more to say. Excellent. Maybe we'll see more at the Game Awards.
Maybe Matthew McConaughey has more to share at the Game Awards.
Well, he literally is a character in the game. He is CC Orlev.
You get a big celebrity to carry your game now. What's the next big celebrity you want to see?
I mean, I don't know. Donnie Yen.
Okay.
There you go. We got a new trailer for Wuchang Fallen Feathers. This was a game that was originally shown off and revealed like in the early 2020s, 2021. It kind of re-revealed itself at an Xbox event over the summer, and then we got a follow-up trailer at an Xbox partner showcase this last week. It is a Souls-like that takes place in a fictional version of, like, I think the Chinese Ming Dynasty, where there's an affliction where characters like start growing feathers and becoming like more bestial in that way. And we got just a kind of a gameplay trailer for it. It's slated for next year. I don't know if that is a new piece of information or if we already knew that. But this one, hey, we actually see a fair bit of like gameplay showing like a lot of spell focused combat in a Souls-like, which we saw a little bit of that. Like, I think of trying to keep these Souls-like apart. It kind of compares most favorably in my eyes to something like Neo, which I did enjoy a lot. So I enjoy seeing that. But yeah, it's just a fun, cool gameplay look in here for Wuching Fallen Feathers shown at the Xbox Partner Showcase.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, I want to give it a shot. It looks like a lot of fun, very high intense, fast action combat. I haven't grown tired of Souls-like genre yet. I usually like to play them whenever I can. I know a lot of people, like, when they hear Souls-like these days, like, ah, oh, it's yeah, another one.
Like, every action game uses, like, the same battle system. Well, it tells you how influential they are, but you want something different, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And for me, I'm just like, I have fun with them generally more than I don't, so mm-hmm. Maybe I'm just a sucker. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did yeah, they do the troll. PC version of Death Stranding?
Yes. Yeah. Very, very just flexible publisher.
And another trailer that we got also at the Xbox Partner Showcase is a trailer for the console version of the Eden Zero Project RPG that was announced, like, I think, years ago. So I'm not sure if we just didn't cover this because it's not really been vogue for, like, the last, like, few years, but I see that we originally covered the announcement of the Eden Zero RPG coming to console and mobile devices back in 2020. And then at the Xbox Partner Showcase, we got the new trailer saying the consoles that will be coming to are PC and Xbox Series X next year in 2025.
No, I don't. I think so, there literally has been no news since then. Yeah. It's not that we just forgot to cover it. There was nothing.
Yeah, I didn't mean to like ensue that. Just like, I wonder if it was just like piecemeal, like little statements from the developers or anything in those ensuing years or anything like that. But
that's why I pinged Adam when it showed up at the Xbox showcase, because I know we like every like 6 months we like remember that like maybe this game exists or not. It's like, hey, remember that Eden Zero thing that Konami announced? Like, oh yeah, that's right. It's like, did they say anything else? No. So, like, I think Adam and I, like, remind each other, like, at least once a year that, like, this thing was announced years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's been 4 whole years since it was announced. That's a long and time.
They never mentioned a peep about it ever again until now. Yeah. So, it was very weird. It's also weird because, like, at the time, I think, they announced it because, like, I think Eden Zero was, like, there's an ongoing TV anime adaptation. And now we're like way past that for this to resurface now. So it's like, do people care? I'm like, I don't know. Maybe. Well,
I think is actually there's a new Fairy Tale game moving out, and I think the anime is still going for that.
There's like, yeah, I think there's a new Fairy Tale anime run going.
It's like, oh, okay, so it's quest, so it's sort of relevant. I'm actually checking Wikipedia. The second season of Eden Zero ended last year. So when this comes out next year, I guess, I don't know, Eden Zero will have been at least a few years lapsed, unless there's a third season that I don't know
about. Yeah, I guess. So it's also kind of weird, too, because when they announced this at the Xbox event, you got your typical trailer of, like, you see some gameplay, but there's no UI, so you don't really know, like, what's really being shown as, like, real gameplay or not, because obviously you can't really tell. And I was like, it's been so long. I'm like, is it still an RPG? And like, and then kind of one of our writers is like, should I cover this? I'm like, just wait to see like if they say RPG at all, because at the Xbox Wire description for it, they didn't even mention it's an RPG either. So I'm like, I don't know. And then it only took to like the store page for it to come up to say it's an RPG. I'm like, okay, like that's fair game then, that it's still an RPG, because I didn't know, because it's been so long.
Yeah, this is actually a little bit behind the scenes for a genre site like ours. We always have to like make a decision, sometimes based on not a lot of information. Do we cover this game or no?
Yeah.
Especially if we have like a CG trailer of a game that calls itself an RPG, and it's like, are you really an RPG? Can we trust you?
A good recent example is also that same showcase for, like, I think it's called Mistfall or something like that. It was in the title. And they call themselves like a mixture of a Souls-like and an extraction shooter, game.
Shooter.
And then they call it RPG in like the Xbox Wire post. And I'm like, I had to read more. It's like it's more like dark and darker. So it's like multiplayer game sessions. And the RPG aspect is more just like you have stats associated, but it's not really an RPG progression sort of quest or adventure like how it would traditionally cover RPG.
Bob, yeah, remember a PR guy asked you, do you cover JRPGs?
We don't want to get into that.
Yeah, let's we don't want to get into that. I feel so bad for the other people at that company.
But yeah, so it's, I guess, cool to see. But there's also the verdict is still out if this Eden Zero console action RPG is coming to any other platforms besides Xbox Series and PC.
So yeah, has Konami, let me check, has Konami like had a press release yet? Let me check.
I don't know. I didn't.
Or is it just check? So that's another thing. No, they don't, at least not in English. That's another thing with these sorts of publisher like platform showcases is like, this is an Xbox showcase. And we got like Xbox's press release on everything, but of course they're not going to mention any other platform. They're just saying this game is coming to Xbox. But yeah, I'm on Konami's press release page right now and they don't have it. So no more details about like, is this coming to PlayStation? I would assume so, but
yeah. And I checked other like Japanese outlets like 4Gamer and Famitsu and like at that time. And then they also just reported that's coming to Xbox Series and PC. Cause I assume they didn't get any press releases either. So if they don't have that, then so
I know I've said this before, but this is still one of the most egregious examples of it. We talked about like Yakuza's Xbox slant sometimes, like the series. But I remember when Scarlet Nexus was announced at an Xbox event, and then Bandai Namco's press release came out, like from Bandai Namco. And usually, more often than not, like nine out of 10 times, the publisher press release will just tell you all the platforms. And I was like, wow, Bandai Namco's press release only mentions Xbox from Bandai Namco, I guess. And even the website only mentions Xbox for Scarlet Nexus. Huh, that's weird. And then like literally like the next day, actually it's coming to everything. It's like, come on.
Yeah, this
also the persona, the persona ports were so weird.
Yeah.
So anyway. Eden Zero. Who's gonna review this? Ciao. Okay.
No, I don't do anime adaptations ever again.
All right, a few other small minor news things. East 10 Nordic's demo is available now. As we talked about that. Heaven Burns Red has confirmed itself a PC release in addition to its mobile release for the upcoming English launch, which I don't think we still have a date for. So the news here is that it is also coming to PC.
Apparently on like the Apple app, like the App Store on Apple, it lists like a November 15 release date for the English version for Heaven Burns Red. Usually they'll never come out and say it until like it's very close. That's kind of like the tentative date, soft confirmed by the App Store. There's an interesting thing because, you know, like, yes, it is a game that is it is mobile first. It does have a PC client that released later in Japan and does have a gacha system. But a lot of people are very excited about this because it is coming from Jun Maeda from Key, very, very talented, you know, script writer, author, you know, did works such as Clannad, you know, so and people can already attest to like the strength of Heaven Burns Red's narrative from the Japanese release. A lot of people who play it are very, when they talk about this game, they talk about the story a lot and how much they really like it. It's basically the very basic premise is like there's like these alien invaders from outer space come to terrorize Earth, and then you have like these like the remaining opposition are like these forces. Some of them are like all girls squadron forces, and I think throughout the story you also see like another academy, like all guys, and their squadron forces, like they have like special powers that can like drive back this alien force, and then it's very character focused, building up the relationships between these cast members and, like, you know, what they go through. And obviously it has, like, that kind of key trademark from Maeda, where, like, it really builds up these relationships and then breaks them down in a very tragic way throughout the story. So this game, Heaven Burns Red, came out in Japan 2 years ago in February 2022, and it, obviously with it coming, you know, late 2024, you know, soft confirmed by App Store once again, if it does hit that date, it'll be, you know, roughly 2 years behind. So obviously, so it's always a matter of the question is, like, is the English release going to try to play catch up? Will it try to maintain this 2 year gap? And it's never consistent. It, like, every sort of situation has, like, their own unique solution on this, where, like, something like Fate Grand Order will always keep, has always maintained that 2 to 3 year gap. And then, like, there are other games that, like, I think the late Star Ocean Anamnesis, for example, tried to play catch up, and then that had its own problems and eventually closed service. And then there were other games that tried to play catch up.
I think that's the first time I've heard a game referred to as the late game. it is dead.
I think the only catch up I see done successfully is probably Epic 7. It catch up to the Korean server in like a year, and then the global version makes more money than the Korean version in the end. So I don't know. It's like I only see like a few successful stories of catch ups. A lot of them just burn to the ground.
So in this release for Heaven Burns Red, YoStar is partnering with developer Right Flyer Studios and Key to bring this to the West. You know, YoStar is well known for like Azur Lane, Arc Knights, and other projects in the West. And they have an interesting solution where they had, like, on their Twitter, they released this, like, this whole infographic of, like, because a lot of people had a lot of questions, understandably, like, what is this going to be the state of this game when you release it? So the long story short, at day one, when this releases in the West, you'll have about 10 months worth of content at day one and the English release. Like, you'll almost have like the full first year's content of the game on day one in English. So you'll have it'll be in terms of like the game version, like the actual client itself, it'll be like version 4.0, which only came to Japan earlier this year, like around February, celebrating its second anniversary. So there's like they had a lot of quality of life improvements that came along with that version, which will be there in the English release. And then along with that, they'll have the main story up to chapter 3, and then they also have like 10 event stories right there from day one as well. So you also have just like a shitload of content at launch that you can just like play for hours and hours on end. And all the event stories are permanent in this game. So like there's like no need to like there's no FOMO in terms of like, oh man, this event only runs from like, you know, from 4 weeks, for example, like other games of this type. So in this game, like all those event stories are permanent. So there's like no need to like, you know, force yourself to like catch up or something. They're always going to be there from the get-go. And to offset some legacy problems with these event stories, that when they were first introduced in the Japanese version, players felt that they rewarded way too little, or they were too grindy in the Japanese release. To offset that, they're also like bumping up like the amount of rewards you get from them, partially because, you know, to make them less grindy, but also to kind of start accelerating like the catch up process to like, I assume YoStar wants to eventually like catch up the English release with like either on par or very close to the Japanese release of the game. So I think it's a really interesting like way to go handle this. I don't know how successful it's going to be, but I know a lot of people are excited. And personally, for me, I generally do like reading Key's visual novels. So I'm thinking oh, maybe I'll give this a shot, since I'm gotcha free. I uninstalled Wuthering Waves a few weeks ago.
So you should just give me that account, and then maybe I'll play it. Who knows?
No, I already uninstalled. I don't know the fucking...
Wait, when did you uninstall?
After a little bit after PAX West.
So you're like a month sober.
Yeah. Okay. You know, so I'm doing good.
He's gotcha free. He's not a drug addict anymore.
That's right. But, you know, maybe I'll give this a shot because it'll have so much content at day one. And people say the story's really good.
Yeah, that's, I have a friend in my Grand Blue crew that is shilling for this game nonstop. He basically says that there are SR versions of characters, and then you can roll for the SR version, and then you could like swap like skills from the SR version to the SSR version or something like that. So that's like one of the things about this game. But
I think most people really talk about the story. Like there's a turn-based RPG aspect, you know, for the gameplay side of it, and reading up like how the meta for this game has like progressed over the years. Seems really dumb. I don't know exactly how free-to-play friendly it is.
Yeah, he didn't talk much of the meta, but he talks about what he really loves about the story is the game remembers your choices. So you make some certain choices in the game like early on. It kind of affects the story, and the game remembers what you chose back then, right?
That's interesting.
And okay. The other thing that he also mentions that like during like story battles, all your characters need to be alive. If any one character gets KO'd within like that battle, that's a game over. Everyone needs to be alive if you want to clear the story segments. So
I remember early on when the game released in Japan, there's actually main story bosses that kicked a lot of the player base's ass. Like it was like way over tuned, so they had to like nerf it. So like, you know, so people could actually like see those.
To make it like I did to clear it perfectly, it's like, man, that might sound pretty brutal. You know? Sometimes you beat a game, it's like a character's dead at the end, right? You
know? Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. Like, people have talked really big about this game's story, and like, I'm always up for a good story. I sometimes I will cross through unreasonable boundaries to witness a good story. Whether it's like, oh, whether I have to play a mobile gacha game, like I'll do it. I'm not beneath it.
The next update we have is for Dragon Ball Z Kakarot, which has the yet another DBZ game that will have DLC that will never die. Very quickly, they are leveraging the release of the new anime series, Dragon Ball Daima, and have announced the first of apparently several DLCs coming to Kakarot to cover Daima. So this is called An Adventure Through the Demon Realm, which is kind of like the tagline for the anime series, which is streaming now on Crunchyroll. And I watched the first episode, and it was all right.
Nice. And they also announced like Daima DLC for Xenoverse 2 as well. Another game that I am not really, surprised. Really not die.
Yeah. Xenoverse 2 came out in 2014, and it's 10 years in, still getting DLC.
And of course, Sparking Zero has just sold like 3 million copies in a day, and I'm sure it's got its plans for, you know.
I mean, there's already Daima there because like a pre-order bonus was Goku Mini. From Daima.
Yeah. I like how they have to like specify the difference between like Kid Goku, GT Goku, you know, Mini Goku. Because it's in Daima, they're wished to be first graders, but they still have like their adult intellect, so it's kind of strange.
I'm kind of glad to like hear like all new voices for the Mini version. Like, yeah, she got like completely new voice actresses like and voice actors for the Mini version, except for Goku. So that's one of the things that you get from Daima.
Well, I know in the English dub, which there's been trailers, but they're releasing the first three episodes in English in theaters, I guess, at the end of the month.
They got the original Kid Goku actress back, which is actually a lot of people like that.
Wow.
They got Stephanie Nadoli instead of Colin Klinkenbeard, who did it for Kai and on since then.
Interesting.
Yeah, nostalgic stuff. But yeah, Daima DLC. Did they announce a release date for this? They just say coming soon, and they have a trailer for it.
No, this is actually pretty typical for the Kakarot DLC. Is they like say it's coming, no idea when and or anything.
It'll come when they say it comes. And that's that'll be like the day of. You know, it's like it's available now. It's like okay, cool.
I did see some screen caps of the second episode, and I guess. The dragon Shenron in English, I think he has a more appropriate name in Japanese, decides to only give the Demon King one wish just because he's not a regular.
Like, yeah, like you gotta fill out.
So I was like, this is the most like Toriyama-ass explanation. He's just like regulars get three wishes. You're new. You only get one wish. You got to fill out your stamp card before I give you more wishes.
People are like complaining already. They're like, how come Frieza gets three wishes or his minions got three wishes? So-
Oh, so funny. You know, Dragon Ball.
He's done his time.
Yeah. they're totally off tangent, but like, just like, because I was like in a Sparky Zero mood last week, I like, there was like a YouTube video that explained all the transformations of like all the different Super Saiyan transformations ever. And I'm like, this makes no fucking sense. Once I got the S cells, I'm like, okay, I'm done. Can't do this.
My favorite, and I'm a casual fan, so I'm not sure if like supplemental material or Dokkan Battle or anything has already covered this, but like Demon King Piccolo was a demon, and then they're like, no, actually he was a Namekian who's just an alien, and then in Daima they're like, well, actually the aliens are from the demon realm, so he truly was a demon, actually.
Yeah, I saw that. Apparently the Namekians are actually demons.
Holy shit. Thank you, Dragon Ball.
Muvlove Tactics, Kalidasa's Nightmare is a turn-based strategy RPG under development for PC.
Yeah, Kai and I are sort of interested because we do like Muvlove, especially the mech aspect of it. It's a really fascinating, like, you know, visual novel series that's like very, very heavy on like mech warfare in it. So not too long ago, they announced this Muvlove Tactics sort of project that they were going.
That's not the gacha game that died in a day, and they brought it back under a different
name. No, it's not Muvlove Dimensions. That's the current iteration of it now. I forgot what it was called before, if it was Dimensions, but it was that game where like it released, then it unreleased because there were so many problems with it, and then it came back, and then it seems to be, I guess, doing fine, I guess. But there's a different project. But we didn't know what kind of project this was going to be, so it's like, okay, well, kind of wait and see. So they had this boarding bridge live stream not too long ago, where they showed off like very, very early prototype footage of this Muvlove Tactics. So it's a strategy RPG that, as Brian said, and it seems to, like, you know, be about like, you know, different classes of mechs as you're deploying them to drive back these aliens called the Beta in the universe of Muvlove. So. And they kind of have like a weird setup for it. Like Anchor, the ones in charge of Muvlove these days, I've been continually relying on crowdfunding projects to sort of gauge interest and also revenue to release these things. Like for example, they had a crowdfunding campaign for Kimiga Nozomu Ien, which is a visual novel which preceded the Muvlove series, and then got like, but then it like it became like relevant as time went on and Muvlove became popular, and so they like fundraised like a remaster of that, and then I guess that's coming to Steam pretty soon, and then so they're also doing a crowdfunding campaign for Muvlove Tactics on this platform called Campfire. I'm not really familiar with that platform.
It's a Japanese crowdfunding website. Mm-hmm. The only reason I know about it is when I briefly covered Witch and Lilies earlier, I found out that it was crowdfunded on Campfire, which was
It's basically, it's like, for people don't say, it's basically the almost like Kickstarter, but in general. And yeah, so I guess they're gonna have some sort of like crowdfunding campaign for this upcoming Muvlove Tactics, but as of now, there's like no real like release date for this game because obviously it has to undergo a lot more development. But as Kite said, reported that it'll come to PCs, Windows PCs first, and then after that, it'll come later to Steam, whatever it's like finalized.
I think now we're ready to go down kind of our date, release date, demo date, other important date rundown to close out this podcast. Available now is a Warframe 1999 in-game demo is available on all platforms with the full game launching this winter. Warframe is a game that I think we have had different contributors on the site have different levels of interest in. So I know Scott has covered a few Warframe things, and now Mikhail is interested in Warframe, so he decided to cover the Warframe 1999 demo. So not something that I am well-versed in, but maybe you'll start seeing more coverage on the site.
Yeah, Mikhail actually asked me, like, why don't we cover Warframe? We should fit, I think. And my honest answer to him was, well, no one here really knows anything about it, so trying to cover it is kind of like
it's kind we of don't a know what we're talking Destiny, about. Where the only time that we cover Destiny is when I can make the time to do it. And honestly, at this point, with all the Bungie layoffs, it's like, well, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, Mikhail is more familiar with Warframe than I would probably than any of us, so he will cover it here or there.
Yeah. So. Well, and most often it's a simple answer like that. Like, why didn't RPG Site cover this? Are they making a statement? Or it's like, well, no, probably just because we didn't have time or couldn't find a person or had to spend too many plates already.
A small amount of regular staff that regularly contribute, and RPGs are, as unfortunately, like everywhere. the longest genre on average, and like in video games. So.
So if the coverage ever seems slightly sporadic, that's because it is. But yeah, Warframe 1999, we'll probably start hearing more about Warframe. And I know Mikhail has expressed some interest in being on this podcast, at least as a regular like visitor. So we might be able to talk about, get that outside perspective of some games that we don't regularly cover here, just due to our participants. Drova, Forsaken Kin. This is a pixel art RPG that was that we first covered back in September. Is now available for consoles and PC.
Yes, this one is kind of interesting in a way because it's published by Deck 13. It's funded by Deck 13 is German, and it's funded through like a German basically fund for this sort of endeavor. So it's like basically this game is coming from like the German indie scene, and I actually don't remember if this was an early access or not. I don't think so, but it's already got like 400 reviews. On Steam, that's pretty good for a small scale title like this being out just a couple of days. So, but yeah, this is like a German pixel art action RPG. I think it was meant to be like Celtic inspired. Yeah, it's based on Celtic mythology. So I otherwise don't know a whole lot about it, but I wanted to highlight, you know, it's kind of fun seeing these independent projects from, you know, these places worldwide.
Yeah, there's so many RPGs like this that I wish I had the time to like play them all. Like, I'm glad that I was even able to play a bit of Felvedeck earlier this year, which that's it cool feels game. Weird that it's been that there's been so many RPGs this year that I almost forgot about that. But that's genuinely probably still in like my top five RPGs this year, just because of how interesting and different and striking it is. But yeah.
RPG Maker With is coming to PS5 and PS4 in Japan on January 30th of next year. It released originally on Switch in Japan in April and eventually released on Switch in the West in October. So just a few days ago, actually. It'll be coming to PlayStation 4 and 5 early next year in Japan, also in the West, but we don't know if it'll be on the same date or slightly misaligned, but coming to Sony consoles at some point next year.
That's a fun pop-up publisher name, Gacha Games.
Mm-hmm. This is a date that I thought we had, but I guess wasn't announced. Trails Through Daybreak 2. Of course, this is Kuroko no Koseki's 2 localized. It's worldwide release coming out next year. We'll be releasing on February 14th, the Valentine's Day for English followers of the Trails series.
February was just missing that classic JRPG. It had Western RPGs, it had a Monster Hunter, it had a Yakuza, had, you know, Kingdom Come, you know, kind of open world, more like immersive sim type RPG.
And, so you're saying February was wide open.
Well, yeah. There was no other JRPG really in February. Yakuza and Monster Hunter don't count. So
You might be misremembering, Brian, that the when you first heard about this announcement is early 2025, but they just finalized the February.
Yeah.
It's
between this Trails in the Sky, the first, which again, Falcom says it's going to be worldwide 2025, and there are English screenshots, so there's no reason to believe otherwise, especially considering it's very clearly using the Xseed script. The fact this is so early in the year, and I've heard explicitly that it, and like we've seen, like even from like I guess like Noisy Pixel had an interview with Nisa at like PAX or something, and they and Anissa Rep even said that alluded to it. They're gonna try and get Kai out next year too, and if that happens, that's gonna be 3 Trails games in English in the same year. Good luck anyone trying to keep on top of them. Good luck.
They've almost done this before because they did the Azure and the Reverie year. What was the other one? There's like another.
It was Niyuta. Niyuta doesn't count. It's a great game. You should play it, but it doesn't count.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I beat Niyuta in like 15 hours. It's much shorter.
It's not quite the same, but it relates to our next topic anyway. But I felt like I was in that space for Yakuza catch up, like all those games coming out on PC and Lost Judgment and all that.
But this is even worse. Like Frozen Sky, the first will probably be for most people like a 30-hour game, so it won't be too bad. There might be new content, who knows? Whatever. But Daybreak 2 and Kai. That's gonna be something, especially since it's only gotten worse as the series has gone on, but it's at the point where transparently Falcom expects you to do everything in each Trails game. There's been
when like second playthrough story beats become like key events.
Yeah, it's like
on the early Gold Steel games.
If I had a dollar for every like cutscene I've had in Kai that's directly called out like a side quest in the previous game, I'd have like a dozen bucks, which isn't
dollars.
A lot. Which isn't a lot, lunch. but the fact that it's happened that many times means that it's like, no, if you're a sicko where you're playing through all the Trails games, you got to be a completionist. I'm sorry, Falcom demands it.
No, I'd say just play them at your own pace, the way that you enjoy them. You know, I'm not gonna tell people to play in a certain order or be a completionist about it. Just play what makes sense for you, what brings you the most joy and fun. You know, that, yeah. I think that places like a unfair, unnecessary pressure on people.
Yeah.
To like play catch up or like they have to do this, do that. It's like, you know, just do it the way that you want to.
And then speaking of Like a Dragon, Yakuza series, Like a Dragon, Pirate Yakuza in Hawaii, which was originally going to release on February 28th, is actually having its release date bumped up a week to February 21st.
Yeah.
I love how like they released a video with that. And like there's like multiple like direct like references to the fact that it's like we ain't built different. We saw we were releasing the same day as Monster Hunter. We got the fuck out of the way.
Yeah. Yokoyama is very he's very transparent about why they decided to bump up this release date. Especially in the Japanese market, you don't want to be released the same day as Monster Hunter in Japan. It's a bad idea.
Honestly, not even just like ever since World, I don't even think you need to say especially the Japanese market. Any market, people are going to prioritize Monster Hunter over Yakuza. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because like this is more of a spin-off game.
We also got a trailer showcasing Naval Combat. It's if I had a nickel every time we talked about Naval Combat in an RPG site podcast.
We have two nickels. Huh.
Maybe this is the game where Adam can find out whether he actually likes Pirate Combat, Naval Combat.
Adam, you recently played through Kingdom Hearts 3. Remind me how that is in Pirate.
Kingdom Hearts 3 is much more arcadey and like ships go down fast. So
he's like, I don't know. So that
neither here nor there, but honestly, that's still my favorite world in Kingdom Hearts 3.
I actually just recently replayed through Kingdom Hearts 3 as well as every other Kingdom Hearts game, and yeah, the Pirates of the Caribbean world is fun.
And then the last headline we have is that Crystar is going to get a PlayStation 5 version in Japan on February 25th. So this is from Furyu and Gem Drops. It's Adam. Remind me, this is like a spiritual
Crystar and Cry Machina are not directly related. They're both Furyu. Right. They're different developers. They have a couple of shared concepts. Crystar is bad, though.
So Crystar is available on PC, Switch, and PS4, and will be coming to PS5. Have a PS5 native version in February in Japan. And that covers us for this podcast. So very detailed dive into Yeast 10. And as we continue to repeat, we have a lot coming up next week. So we'll have obviously the release of Yeast 10. So those that didn't have pre-release access will be able to play it. But then we also have Romancing Saga 2 remaster. Obviously, it'll be a big headline for next week. But yeah, we do have the metaphor guides that Josh has shared the, you know, done up the lion's share of the work on, along with some work with a few other contributors up on the site. If you're playing through Metaphor like I am, we have those up on the site, and we're continuing to like cover what people are searching for and tweak what we've got up there to make your experience playing that as helpful as possible. We do also have the Discord, so discord.gg/rpg site, or hit the link at the top of the homepage if you're interested in joining that. You can find RPG site on most of the social media networks. Just search for RPG site and you should be able to find us. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Tetracast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe and take care. I'll talk to y'all later.